Either the speaker or the chairperson of the committee has to write to us, say what the situation is. Now, we'll start with the first thing.
On the 25th of February 2007, I went to brief the committee together with the member of the department. The mandate from the province is that public hearings have been held in the mentioned municipalities, that is Kopano, on the first and the second at Kopano municipality, Kim Harris and Metimaholo at Sizile David district. Therefore, the committee from the legislature resolved that we vote in favor of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. That was the first day. The next one will be the office.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mandated or as instructed as instructed by the constitutional requirement, on the 23rd of last month, I met the portfolio committee of the province, which is relevant to the bill. Fortunate enough, I was given a very able person from the department, Mr. Martin Masemola, and the portfolio committee brought along advisors from the government, state law advisors. And the discussions have been so brilliant that it was for the first time that they discussed the issues at that level since I joined the legislature. Now, they pointed out a number of things. I think you might see these on page 2. Page 1 and page 2, although the pages are not numbered. Now, these are not issues of problematic consideration. That's a question of giving specific meaning to specific words and some phrases. And then at the end, it was agreed that they will conduct the public hearings and the mandate will be in by the 24th, as they said. But I think it was just a day later or so. But they supported.
When was the public hearing?
No, they conducted them. I think it was 2 days after I left, on the 24th, 25th, somewhere there. But they didn't specify. But then the committee supported the bill and they gave us the mandate to support it here as well. Thank you.
Yes. Then we will come to
KZM. Chairperson, thanks. The Committee on Local Government and Traditional Affairs was briefed in KZN, and we had the biggest support from the department, the DME. I think three officials were present. And after a lot of deliberation and clarification, the committee then decided to hold two public hearings, which they held. And finally, on the meeting that was held, KZN has decided to, as a result, to support the bill unreserved.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I went to have the briefing on the 20th February, and after the briefing, local government portfolio committee decided in compliance with its duty in terms of section 118 of the constitution, the committee received that resolved that the written submission be invited to the radio and newspaper and advertisement in order for the committee to decide on the necessary of calling a public hearing. Advertisement on radio on the and print media was made from Saturday, 24th of February, to the Thursday, 1st of March, 2007. And then another meeting of the committee was held on the 2nd of March, 2007, to further consider the detail of the principle of the bill informed by the view of organized local government, the Department of Local Government, and other interests of stakeholders. written submissions were received from ESCOM and the City of Aduani. Saga Hao Chen, by way of email, correspondence indicates that the provincial office of Saga will not have a provision that is not informed by the provision of Saga National. They, however, failed to attend all arranged committee's meeting and express any views, including that which they claim to be aligned themselves to. Due to that situation, the committees which decide provisionally support the bill and the select committees indulging to allow the committee to propose further amendments to the views of both Saga's Haoqian and that provincial executive substantive bear social, economic, financial, and political implications for the provincial. For the province, that they require consideration prior to the passage of the bill by the NDLC. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Then, the one Mr. Hendra, please, not here. I will have to take it from me to all mother. There's no one from another city. You see, that's in the province. I'll then vote for the Western team. The Standing Committee on Governance had considered this, and though it's not on paper, and I think I will have to go back to the province and say this is not enough. Well, I know the Republic having in Old Jordan, Palmas, Bree, and Talisman that were held. But they support the bill and they are not amending anything. We have the negotiating money for the Northern Cape. They do support the bill, but they've raised concerns that municipalities should enter into agreement with the service provider and should be responsible for solely supplying communities. Tariffs in all districts should be equal. The provision of electricity to farms should be clearly outlined, which is something that the municipality must take up. The minister be granted more power to intervene on certain matters. The law must ensure better access for vendors. The national government should budget to assist the provinces in the implementation of the bill. And their committee commented as the possibility of a power station at Wenatchiap Bay, because the distribution of the electricity from Western Cape to the Northern Cape will result in higher tariffs. I think you have to comment more on the wall-to-wall of red here. Maybe there's a little misunderstanding from the province. And the National Treasury should capacitate and enable smaller municipalities to regulate, and the legislature should continue to lobby for a greater share of money. So those are for the legislature. So their mandate is to support the bill and ask the department to take concerns, to take note of the concerns they have raised. Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Hendricks.
Let me just tell you that our mandate is too short.
Oh.
Too summarized. It doesn't speak of processing.
Oh.
It has to be. Such that you say we were briefed on this day, this is what happened, without saying the results of the public hearing. But I will speak to the chairperson immediately when I'm coming to you.
Okay.
It's typical of the old world Monday. Thank you. Let's give will you comment as we have done, starting with questions? So that you respond to the concerns of it.
Okay, Chair, if I can just be granted the latitude because we only received the mandate this morning, but I think most of the issues are very positive and we can make some comments on them. Support, no problem.
I'll show that the next time you get them, you can come.
Chair, I think...
Sorry, Mr. Chairman. Mrs. Chamber, I'm very sorry.
Thank you, Chair Susanna. I just wanted to raise the concern that was raised by Van Bumalanga to say, are we still, as the NCOP, considering the 6 weeks, the 6 weeks cycle, as it was raised that we are now moving from the 4 weeks to... Then when they, I was raising that negotiating mandate, we need it by the 6th, and they said they raised that question. So I just wanted to raise it.
Thank you, honorable member. Thank you for the opportunity again, and maybe to thank you for the support and for a process that was very well organized and completed. We were very anxious to see it coming to this point, and believe that they have indicated to me almost at the end of March. But Chair, just to report or make some comments by exception, because for example, most of the provinces have indicated in writing that they support the bill. Maybe to just comment on some of the, if you like, the qualification of the concerns that have been raised, starting, for example, with the Northern Cape. Chair, to mention that members can will recall that we are busy with another process, which is the process of the structural adjustment, the so-called rate process. This process that we have gathered here today about relates to the regulatory adjustment, and it concludes the regulatory framework that covers municipalities. And I think in that context, we will now not pass too much commentary on the issues that relate to the structural adjustment, because there is a process, a very rigorous process that we have started, which will come to this committee itself regarding the rate. But for example, they are mentioning that tariffs in distance should be equal. And Chair, this is, without reading too much into it, but I believe this is in line with what we are proposing in terms of the rate project, where we're saying that the regulator will have a national best eye view, so to speak, as to how tariffs can be adjusted in a fair and equitable way. Because currently what obtains is that there are over 2,000 tariffs, or some of them with no basis as to how they were calculated, and it does not bode well for especially members of the sections of the community that cannot afford that. I think this is very valuable as an input from the Northern Cape. The issue of the provision of electricity is too far. Our minister has made it clear that she would like us to align with the president's call for universal access by 2012 in financial year. And the electrification process will be fast-tracked to cover within farms and households. And I think the big message that comes out of this process is that with a firm and more rigorous regulatory environment, electrification is then going to become a lot easier to firstly to intervene, but to fast track and to get the program. The issue of service delivery agreements, every now and then we're confronted with the problem. Everything, if I can mention, especially between ESCOM in certain traditional areas where they are the licensed supplier and the municipality around the conditions for supply and so forth. And this bill does cover that, and it says that an external service provider like ECOP must enter into service delivery agreement with the respective municipality for them to provide the service. So we support that share. And then obviously the issue of budget share, unfortunately, is out of our mandate to comment on the budget, saying that national government should budget in the implementation of the COPCHA bill. The message is there to support, but we believe that it will take it to the appropriate structure. Coming to the let's skip the working chair because it's here. The comments from Limpopo in particular, they mentioning the qualifications to include, for example, the definition of reticulation, to the extent that it is not clear how it would be, how it should be distinguished from distribution. If I refer you to the definition section J, is in fact, if you recall, this was one of the most contentious issues, how we deal with the definition of reticulation, and I believe we have covered that quite adequately in the way that we have said reticulation and distribution are tantamount to the same thing. They have raised, I think they've been very rigorous in terms of the way in which they have even referred to some typos and so on, such as oversight on our side, and we will correct that. You know, some sections that they say overlap and they are incomplete. So comment on those. We will change those accordingly. In fact, we're just saying with the state advisor that some of those changes are very obvious. The Free State does not have any preservation. Then coming to the housing one share, I think I must say that it's a question of process as far as I understand, and please forgive my limited understanding, but it says that there is provisional support for the bill, and then they would like to get your indulgence to propose further amendments, and I believe that it's related to an assessment of the financial and political implications on their province. But yeah, I don't know how the process accommodates that, because it would be much more useful if we have those further amendments as they would like them to be included. At this point, we don't have those amendments, so we're not in a position to pass any commentary on that. But I think, in the main, my assessment is that most of the things that have been raised here can still be accommodated in one of two ways, firstly by an explanation, by additional explanation and deliberation over what we actually mean, what we intend, in other words, the broad philosophy of this bill, and then to deal with the detailed concerns that might still be raised. But I guess the other issue relates to the structural side of things, which is the rate process. And there are slight overlaps between the two processes, but the department has taken a deliberate decision to split the two processes. We're dealing now with regulation only, and very soon we will start with the structural adjustment issues, and then the picture will be complete. So I would propose that we will take leadership from you as to how we deal with make up a provisional support. I think I have covered the ones that I have indicated, let's say they would support under the decree and so on. We thank them for that. And we should just leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Elton. Members, we now need to engage the department, particularly of the concerns that are raised in your presence. But let me ask something, Mr. Elton. I understand the regular process. But you see, the one worrying factor, if I may raise it, is that you're bringing change in peace. We're now looking at regulation. Sometimes we will now bring in other parts. And I would assume because you're still dealing with red, it will still be at regulation. Let me just say the problem will be time, because when we look at how much time was spent in Parliament, they say in total it would be about 5 months. Because in April we will not be here for the whole month. July again, the constituency period of end of September. So if you count that also, that now has an effect on what Mrs. Kemba raised, the MCOP cycle. Well, we've taken a very short cycle, and I think we're not being fair to provinces, particularly because we have to make sure that provinces hold public care. It can't go to a standing committee in the legislature and come back from there to us here without them doing that process. It's necessary for them to do that. So that's one other concern we will have. And you see, this is so because of when you don't have fixed time when you have to deal with a bill in the NE, which affects us as well. Well, I remember this started last year already, and we're considering it only this year. It says we will not be, the other house must not do its work very well. And I also want to say we would have to work, we will only have 2 weeks here. We will have next week, and we have the other week. Because other province, or one province in fact, or two provinces, is not hold public hearings as well, would have to give them time. And we want to consider our final mandate by the 20th. Which is too short a time as well. But it also is affected by the fact that the NCOP will be going to housing next week. But I want to propose, members, that we be given some slots to go ahead again. I think this coming Thursday and Friday are also briefing days for the NCOP. I'll just look at the program now. If it is so, No, it's not. We have a plenary. We have a plenary on Friday. I'm not sure, but we'll have to plan and have something. Yes, we have to do the break. We will see when the department is not here, then we can settle. So I give over to you now, members, to make sure that you interrogate the areas of concern your province has. Let's check with the province that has no money to pay something.
Anyway, thanks. No, I wanted to re-emphasize the point that you have just alluded to. That of this 60-foot cycle, which also Comrade Tema referred to. That really, we want the department to understand that our approach is sort of a two-pronged approach, that of NCOP as well as the provinces. And the provinces, sometimes they feel that we come to them as big brothers. When we say this is
and for them, why every time we bring a bill to them, it's only sent. So they sometimes fail to understand this process. That's what we should emphasize at point. And to say, with regard to these public hearings, sometimes if that process has not been thoroughly exhausted, you know, we end up opening them to court challenges and stuff like that. So I think we need to assist them when it comes to that as well. Thank you very much. That was just the remark I wanted to make, and I don't want to make any further comments because of your house.
Any other concerns, member? Lillian Masaila, your apology was tendered.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. When I was in the province, I have the inputs here, which is very few, which I can read to the department and the chair in the city. But there was one concern raised, which I see is not here. And that is that what is going to happen if the municipality does not comply, especially in relation to finances, not voluntarily or purposefully. That came through very strongly. And then for my province sake, I would like the department to come through very clearly on this 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 inputs. It's very short if the chair would, honorable chair would please allow me. That the municipality should enter into agreement with the service provider and should be responsible for solely supplying communities. 2, tariffs in all districts should be equal. 3, the provision of electricity to farms should be clearly outlined. 4, the minister to be granted more powers to intervene on certain matters. 5, the law must ensure better access for vendors. 6, the national government should budget to assist the provinces in the implementation of the bill. Thank you, Honourable Chair.
Any other hands?
Okay. I don't quite remember which province it is. I think there is one which says they support the bill provisionally.
Okay.
Who are those? What actually does that mean in terms of the processes we are involved in?
There are two people. You either support or you don't. You can't be in the middle. How can you have not followed properly? So I think what we will do is we'll set up in time to those provinces. Yes. But we also must go back to our provinces. So that by the 20th you come back to the committee and you say what finally the province is. Let me respond to Ms. Matayo's question. Unfortunately, Mr. Apani has dealt with that, so Chaban will help you. We'll wait a minute. Unless Mr. Apani wants to respond quickly, we will have another person in the and push back. But I'm not saying you must not respond. If you want to speak directly to me, okay.
Sorry, I misunderstood. With your permission. Thank you. The concern relating to tariffs and that they should be equal in all districts, what we are saying is that it is consistent with an effort to rationalize the 2,000 plus tariffs that currently so we are in sync on that one. It is a process that we would like to fast track, in fact, to make sure the tariffs are rationalized. And in fact, we're saying, or rather, the concern is that in the, they should be the same in the district, but we're saying that it's actually even bigger than that. It's in the region, it's in the public. But I think the concern is noted. We are aware of the problem where, you know, across the street, you know, some tariffs could be different.
Thank you.
the issue of the service provider agreement is the service delivery agreement requirement. It is in the Minister of Systems Act. We are reinforcing it in terms of this amendment again, whereby, or in terms of which we require for EFCOM, as an example, to not provide electricity within certain municipalities or within any municipal area without the agreement being in place. In fact, there is a draft mandatory service delivery agreement that has been circulated for comment, and we're almost at the point of finalizing it. Regarding of electrification, really to farms, schools, clinics, households, and so on, we're saying that our minister has made an undertaking to support the president's, if you like, radical in 2004, with the nation of the Universal Act of 2012. In other words, by the end of 2012, we have universal access to electricity. In fact, in that regard, the National Treasury has allocated even more funding in order to do that. And I guess what we'll have to do in relation to the Northern Cape in particular is to look at the issue of the farm connections or farm dwellers that we have access to electricity. We support the national government responsibility to support the provinces in the implementation of the bill. In fact, the member might be aware that the constitutional requirement for national government to support the other tiers of government. And then there is the issue about the minister being granted more power to intervene on certain matters. We believe that the bill as it stands does provide enough leeway for intervention, be it of a support measure, be it intervention of a corrective measure, if you like, kind. And we believe that that is already in place. In the context of supporting municipalities in particular. And then the issue about the law must ensure better access for vendors. Honorable Chair, we would have to engage in it because I'm not sure like, where it comes from. But I guess if it relates to the fact that the municipality might want to use vendors outside of their own mechanism. For example, the village in the municipal system there, you know, where they can opt for external service providers. They have to follow the process, you know, the so-called Section 78 process and so on. That the law provides for already in terms of the municipal system. That is for the municipality if they want to do that. And if it means you must engage the council for that, you know, how this law has been engaged there. I think that's sort of it. Thank you, Chair.
Do you want any other
clarification?
Thank you,
Honourable Chair,
I'm fine.
Now, we take this back to our provinces and we come back on the 20th. And you see the only problem with provinces that did not submit their money. Mpumalanga, Eastern Cape and North West. There was no other opportunity. The world will be considering the money for the last time on the 20th, given the pressure. And I think when we debate, we will raise the processes within the NCOC, that how we don't follow those. Let me just check something from Ms. McGrell. Are you saying the department wants a power station built in one club?
That is what they want, as you can see.
But would that be in return for nuclear waste disposal? It's like Western Cape Place was the disposal.
What I would say, they only raised the distance Western Cape to the Northern Cape, and in relation to that there must be an increase in time.
No. Well, let's congratulate your province for having had increased numbers, one. With a new demarcation. At least, I think you're at a million now. One. Two. every province participated towards the process of launching the first list, which is in Tito. And unfortunately, it was agreed that it will only be six. Six meaning these metropolitans. And it's not true as well that there's a distance. You know the distance would be because your province is big, very big, but sparsely populated, unlike other provinces. But as things are, then let's make sure that we convince them now that they don't raise things that have been finalized and where MEPs participated and in the process in the NCOP as well, they participated. So the mandate is very clear on that one. And you see, if we take it the Northern Cape way, it's going to set up a problem that are already existing with Cape Town. So the more we raise that, the more problems the department will have to have. And I'm not saying that let's make work easier for them, but again, let's be reasonable. Thank you very much. Yes?
Thank you, Chairperson. If I may, just to alert to the Chairperson and the committee members, the Office of the Chief State World Advisor was approached by National Treasury in regard to a concern that National Treasury has. And the concern was towards all regulations in clauses 2 and 3. The concern leads to the fact that they say that this might lead to constitutional challenges where the reticulation function will then bring it into the ambit of the regulator. And the impact of this would be that the regulator will then ultimately decide on the licensing conditions and functions, and they can even then suspend or revoke the license of the municipality. And because this is a constitutional mandate given to municipalities to reticulate, this might lead to an infringement of that constitutional mandate given to municipalities. We have discussed it with the department, and the department is also then in agreement to remove the word or reticulation from clauses 2 and 3. Thank you, Chairperson. I thought I'd just bring that under your attention.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I don't want this here in the House to understand wrongly that what this concern, the Northern Cape supports the ball. Thank you very much.
No, very clear. Mr. Japanic, you want to say something on what the paper?
Chair, thank you very much. I'm glad that it has been introduced by the State Advisor for the record, but I think it would form part of the package of the cleaning up of the bill. You know, some members
follow the next process.
The next process, when we, I presume, when we come back and we finalize this, we'll all the typos and that. But we don't believe it's a very substantive matter that we propose. We have discussed it.
Will you be happy, therefore, if we take it to the next process?
It
will be part of this bill.
I'm quite happy.
Members, any other thing you wish to raise? No. Well, welcome, Judge. Unfortunately, your mind is not here as well. You and your homes are hollow. But you have to
I'm not sure whether it has been recorded that the member who was supposed to have taken the place had a problem on the way. Then I did make the work of the briefing on Thursday. With this gentleman, I hope you are not in your session today. I hope everything will go well. I don't know if then there will be fundamental changes to make submission the submission on the ministry. I understand. I think the committee has accepted consequences.
We raise that. Let's now make on the 20th department officials. Then that day we will finalize everything. Whatever is not finalized, we'll raise in the House and the Minister will. question. Thank you very much for your time. We'll have lunch, but we still have to interact with the president of the second in the committee by Oxford. You can come and join us. Thank you very much for your time.
Hey, not yet. I want to see somebody, you know. But I want you to give me somebody, don't know another issue.
Okay. I will see some other in the video. Yes, you may, ma'am. Mostly technically, where were these people off? Some money somewhere here.
I've got a fairly longish presentation, so I don't want to go through it quickly. I'm under some time constraints around this. But I'd like you to feel free to stop me if I'm not there in terms of this question you, of the issue that you need some further clarification on, or you can say a question for the air. I've been asked to do a presentation on our annual report for 2005-2006. Now that information is a bit dated. A lot has happened in the year since that financial year has ended. So I'll talk about what we did in that financial year, but I'll kind of talk about some of the more current issues we're dealing with, because that's what you're going to read about in the newspaper. So I'll just try to update people as well as what's happened. I thought what I'd do to start off with is just kind of go over what is competition policy and why we need it. What is this thing, competition policy? And essentially, you know, in a lot of economic debates that occurred in the mid to late 90s, a lot of which occurred in Black, competition became an important principle that was adopted in terms of the kind of principle that we need to infuse in all areas of the economy, because this was seen as something that's going to deliver on the kinds of objectives we set around economic growth and growing the economy generally. But it also takes into account where we come from historically. South African economy is characterized by very high levels of concentration. This is something that happened historically. And with a situation where you have few firms dominating certain markets, a number of problems arise in economics. So one is that people, if these markets are tied up by a few players, then other people, other new incumbents, new entrants will find it difficult to enter this market. So higher levels of competition is trying to achieve a situation where we can get new people coming into the economy, new entrants. But that means tackling the stranglehold that the existing players, the existing dominant players have in those markets. We need to kind of make sure that their behaviors are not such that prevents new entrants from entering the market. So competition is seen as something that creates a fairness around everybody having opportunity to participate in the economy, and it gives people access to the economy. But also what competition does in economics is that if firms are competing, then prices will drop. Okay, so you go to one person to buy item X and he's selling it for 10 rand, and somebody else is competing with him will sell it for 9 rand, and a third person will come and compete to sell it for 8 rand. Prices fall with competition. If you've just got one player, if you've got a monopoly, for example, suppose there was a monopoly selling bread. Okay, just you could only buy your bread from one place, one person, one firm. You're at the mercy of that person's price. There's no other person around to compete and bring prices down. You will be at the mercy of that person. So competition is important for bringing prices down, and one of our economic objectives more generally is around tackling the issue of inflation, and of course keeping prices down is good for a low inflation rate. The other thing that competition does is it improves the quality of products. So you producing a particular product and I make a better, improved version, people will then come to buy my product, and you'll be incentivized to produce an even better product than me. So quality improves, and so does innovation. It is competition, through competition that people create new ideas, new products, new improved products that meet consumer needs. And of course, finally, competition is important for consumer choice, because if consumers have varying tastes, if all shoes looked alike, you wouldn't have a choice in buying this pair of shoes that best suits your needs or your personality or your style or whatever it is. So competition is important in that respect as well. Now, the competition commission, the competition act was promulgated in 1999. It was a consequence of the Nedl Act negotiations where business, government and labor agreed on the policy principles, and this was translated into legislation. What the legislation does broadly, there's three things that these authorities do, very broadly speaking. One is prosecuting anti-competitive behavior. This is when a firm or a group of firms that behaved anti-competitively in the past, we can prosecute them. This is what we've done with SAA, for example, which I'll speak about just now. The second thing is merger control. So prosecuting anti-competitive behavior is behavior that's already occurred. Merger control is you anticipating what will happen if two firms merge and become more dominant in a market. So merger control is to prevent, going forward, higher levels of concentration in the economy. So if a merger is going to result in a monopoly or one firm having too much of power, then we will prohibit it on those grounds. This is something, for example, that happened in the Pick and Pay The other thing we do, and it's becoming an increasingly important part of our work, is advocacy. And here it is about getting all other institutions and policies, a lot of which will come to this forum, to be competition friendly should be consistent with competition policy. Okay, and it's just about winning people's minds over and hearts over, changing the way people work without being, without using the stick, without using our enforcement mechanism, which is, you know, a very legalistic thing. So advocacy is what we do, for example, with other regulators. We say CASA, we say, look, man, you know, that particular policy of yours is not very competition friendly. This is increasingly becoming an important aspect of our work, because we can't always change behaviors through prosecution. It's very time consuming, very resource intensive thing to hire lawyers, and, you know, sometimes a better strategy is to get people to comply voluntarily with the principles of competition rather than pulling out the stick and prosecuting them. The Competition Act, those broadly are the three things that we do. Okay? The Competition Act has application of all economic activity that has an agricultural impact. So this includes all enterprises, public or private, doesn't matter who owns them. FAA, as you know, is owned by government. We have no problem with kind of tackling companies that are owned by any level of government. Our act even allows us to catch activity that's done extraterritorially. So if a bunch of firms in the United States are sitting down to collude about how they're going to operate in the South African market, we have jurisdiction over them. So any activity in South Africa. One of the things around our act that is proving to be, may prove to be more difficult going forward, is the issue of concurrent jurisdiction. Where there's a sector-specific regulator, and that sector-specific regulator, say NASA or CASA, has powers over issues related to competition, we sometimes share jurisdiction with them. And this is something that can prove to be difficult if incumbents, if private parties out there begin to play us up against each other, which is a tendency they have. In other words, they kind of come to, they fall in shock, they decide which is the regulator that will give them the best deal, and then they assert that is the regulator that's regulating me, nobody else is. And that's a bit of a difficulty that we are trying to overcome through discussing with other regulators and reaching memorandums of understanding with them around how we'll tackle situations where we do both have jurisdiction, where there is in fact concurrent jurisdiction. Just briefly, this is a slide that just shows a picture of the institutions that this Act set up. The Act set up three institutions, the Commission, the Tribunals, and the Competition Appeals Court. And a nice way of thinking of these three institutions is to think of the Commission as the police and the prosecutor. So the Commission is where you make your complaint. They will investigate this complaint, and if they find there's a case to be made, they will then prosecute it. And they prosecute it before the tribunal, which is effectively the court of first instance. The tribunal will adjudicate it and make its decision. If somebody is unhappy with the decision of the tribunal, they can appeal that decision at the Competition Appeal Court, which is a specialist division of the High Court. Okay, so whereas the tribunal is an administrative body, the adjudicator is made up of lay people, you know, they're kind of qualified people, but they're not judges. The Competition Appeal Court comprises of judges of the High Court. Okay, just to give you a picture of what happens when we get a complaint. So when we get a complaint, you know, this is a snapshot, the numbers are at the end of that financial year, that's where we were at in terms of these different numbers. But more importantly, it's just the kind of flow of what happens. when we get a complaint, we investigate it. We can do one of two things in investigating it. We can say, look, there's no case here, let's not refer it. If we don't have enough evidence to make a case, let's not refer it. It goes away. If we do make a case, we refer it to the tribunal. When we're ready to refer it, one of two things can happen. We can either go to the tribunal and the respondent will defend themselves and say, look, the commission is wrong, this is the reason why we're doing whatever it is we're doing. And there we can, you know, there's a number of different outcomes. We can either, a lot of times, parties challenge one or other aspect of the law without some jurisdiction, the meaning of the law. There's a lot of interlocutory applications, and private parties with deep pockets can wreak havoc around that stuff, where they kind of, instead of getting to the merits of the case, they're picking up side issues and taking on side issues. The respondent could win the case. They could, that's the second outcome. They could find, the tribunal will find in their favor. Or the commission, the authority, could win the case. In other words, the tribunal will approve or agree with the commission's view. That's if the case goes to a hearing. Another thing that's increasingly happening recently is parties, when we are on the verge or after having referred the case, are increasingly becoming keen to settle with us. Okay, so they say, look, let's settle, we'll pay a fine, because let's deal, you know, that sort of thing. Let's not go to the trouble, we're not drawing out legal proceedings. And we open to those settlements, because that's also in our interest. A lot of resources go into legal proceedings. Just to give you an idea, in the financial year under question, of some of the kinds of cases we've had in these complaints, these price fixing cases, these competitive cases. We, which was well known well reported in the newspaper, we had a case against seven motor manufacturers and their dealerships. Okay? And there were two issues here. And essentially, this case was settled. In other words, we didn't go to the, we didn't prosecute it, it was adjudicated, we settled it. They agreed to pay fines totaling something like 34 million rand. Altogether. And there were two issues here. One is, okay, so within this thing you have dealers who sell cars to the end consumer, and you have the manufacturers who make the manufacturers of their cars. And we found two practices. One is the manufacturers were saying to the dealers, you will sell this car at this particular price and we will not sell it at any lower a price than what we are telling you. This is a thing known as minimum retail price maintenance, where the supplier puts a condition on the retailer saying, look, you can't go below this price. That prevents competition, because if different dealers were competing with each other, they would have an incentive to bring the price lower and lower, but they're prevented from doing so because part of the agreement with the supplier is that they ought not to do so. And of course, you know, if you don't listen to your supplier, it'll stop supplying you. So the supplier has a lot of power in this relationship. The other thing we found is that in addition to that, dealers for each particular model or each particular brand of motor vehicles have what we call a dealer council. This is where all the dealers, say BMW in Gauteng or in Western Cape or internationally, will get together, and we found that dealer council was a forum for collusion. In other words, all the dealers were kind of saying, look, let's not compete with each other, let's set the price of this motor vehicle at this particular level. And they were therefore not competing with each other. So it didn't matter whichever dealer you went to, you know, consumers didn't. You know, in the normal course, you go to dealer A and that dealer gave you a price, and you go to dealer B and you say, look, that guy's giving you so much, then he gives you less. But people were finding that whichever dealer they went to, all the dealers were saying, look, we can, oh, this is the price, and we're all the same. There was no competition between those dealers. Another case we did in that year was around airlines where they say fixed trading conditions around in South African Airways and Lufthansa set prices on the Joburg-Frankfurt fleet, and they were not competing. There were the only two airplanes doing that particular thing. We settled here with both Lufthansa and SAA, where they both paid fines. They specifically asked for what I talk about South African Airways, but that was our biggest case by far in that 2005-2006 year. Here, what happened is a very interesting story, is that we got complaints from essentially the other airlines, Nationwide on the one hand, and then you see the bottom, Comair, gave us the same complaints as well. And the complaint was about how South African Airways views its dominance in the relationship it had with travel agents. So South African Airways set up an incentive scheme for travel agents where, you know, they gave travel agents points or discounts, or they gave the individual agents, the people who are selling tickets, they gave them kickbacks in terms of voyage and miles and various other things. To sell a South African Airways ticket to a consumer, even when there was a cheaper ticket available for another airline. So you went to the airline and you said, give me a cheaper ticket to Joburg, and the person across the counter was incentivized to sell you a South African Airways ticket, even when there was a Comair or Nationwide ticket that was cheaper. So the consumer wasn't getting the best deal here because, you know, the power of South African Airways that had over these travel agents kind of enabled them to get the agent's behavior to work in their favor. This was a case that we litigated. In other words, went to a full trial. We had, you know, it took a long time. There were many, many days of hearings. The South African Airways tried to defend it. They lost the case. Okay? The Competition Tribunal imposed a penalty of 25 million rand on us. South African Airways then decided that it was going to appeal the case. When they did so, the commission said, okay, you're going to appeal the case, we're going to cross-appeal the case, which means that our view is that this fine is too low. At which point, South African Airways backed down. Okay, and they said, okay, look, you know, they understood. They ran the risk with our cross-appeal of that 25 million rand being increased, because we were saying, you know, this is terrible behavior on your part. And when they did that, they then backed off. We had three other cases in the pipeline against South African Airways. They then approached us and they said, look, let's settle all our cases with you. We want to play ball with you. We want to put together a compliance program. We want to be able to comply with the rule. And we want to settle all the cases. And so those three cases under the heading of the consent agreement, which was collusion cases for funds that I spoke about before. There was also collusion around fuel levies that all the airlines had charged commonly. And there was a similar case to the one that was prosecuted, but except it was the complaint came from Comair instead of Nationwide. And in total, South African Airways had fines levied of 100 million rand against them, which we've agreed that they should pay over a period of 3 years. Okay. Then there's a whole bunch of current cases. I'm sorry to do this, but the most interesting part of this work is in the case. There's a long list of cases. Each case is unique, and each case has its own characteristics. So it's a long list of cases, and that's how you get to understand what the principles are behind the law. I'm going to have to go through that, but I'll be briefer with you. Harmony Gold and Mittal Steel, this is a complaint that was not taken on by the Science Commission. It was not prosecuted by the Commission. In fact, the Commission about 3-4 years ago non-referred this case. The Science was not an easy case to fight, and it was not referred. It's was something that the Department of Trade and Industry was not happy with, because they were pushing very hard for the issue of import parity prices to be dealt with. So that's what this case is about, import parity prices. And so how many goals within a private sector player, a mining company, then on its own steam, litigated a case against Mittal around the price of black steel products. Okay, it was an excessive pricing case. This case was heard last year, and the tribunal's decision on this case is pending. It should be heard next month. Okay, so that's something to look out for. The other current case is around Sava and Telkom. Sava is the South African Fans Association. These are the value-added network services. So all the guys who do internet services, networking services for companies, you know, the value-added services that you need, whatever, case management systems, communication systems within companies. They took a case against Telkom. All of these companies that do value-added services are completely reliant on Telkom's infrastructure to do their work. Okay, so they produce the software, but it's through the hardware of Telkom's infrastructure that it gets communicated. And essentially, they complained that Telkom was either being discriminatory in the charges they charged them for using the infrastructure, or was discriminating both on price and service. You know, they were at the mercy of Telkom here around, because there was only one player and it was dominant and it charged them any price. And we found that there was indeed a case here, and we began litigating it, at which point Telkom took us to the High Court saying we don't have jurisdiction over them. They're the only institution that has jurisdiction over them, which you can't run. So this is a case of forum shopping that I referred to earlier. We've got a solid case against Telkom, but Telkom is giving us the runaround in terms of taking us to all the different courts, questioning our jurisdiction and playing us up against the Carter. Okay. This is going to become an issue, I think, more generally, and one of the advocacy things we're doing, I should say at this point, is we're going to suggest to public enterprises that, look, you know, if you own by the state and if you're a publicly owned company, you know, in terms of government being a shareholder, it is our expectation that these companies behave in an exemplary way. It is a bit embarrassing for us to be taking up cases against government-owned institutions, but there are cases here to be taken up. You know, these are important cases. Telecommunications is something by far that's going to unblock this economy, and if it's blocked by bad behavior, dominant firms, we're going to have difficulties going forward. The other current case we have that's long-standing is a case of ANSAC and Bordash. ANSAC is an American cartel, American Natural Soda Ash Corporation. It's a cartel. It's operating in South Africa. Bordash is Botswana Ash. It's a company, a joint venture between the Botswana government and Anglo-American. And they complain that ANSAC is operating as a cartel in this country. We found that wasn't the issue. We did case up against ANSAC, and this is another instance where a respondent with very deep pockets are giving us the runaround by taking every court and appealing every small decision we take. We could get there with this case for 7 years. Another very important case is Profert Sasol, and this is a case very briefly about fertilizer, the pricing of fertilizer, chemicals that go into making fertilizer, and the high prices thereof. Profert is claiming that Sasol is charging at a very high price for its input materials, such as the chemicals, such as nitrogen-based chemicals, and of course the high prices of fertilizer have little effect on the economy. High prices of fertilizer, high prices of farming costs, high food costs, and it's something that is the kind of input that's important when prices are low there. More recent cases against dairy producers, and here we found that there was price fixing. Okay, the way this industry is structured is you have a milk producer, that's the person that owns the cows and milks the cows, and you have a milk processor, so that's the person who takes the milk and puts it in bottles and pasteurizes it and makes cheese out of it. Okay, and we found that the prices here were set at both levels, that in fact the processors were very, very powerful in the chain and could determine what prices the farmers were paid for the product, for raw milk, and we found that they also had the ability to get prices in detail of milk. It's a case that was referred to the tribunal, and it will be heard shortly. Okay. Another important case we've had is around grain silos. Grain silos are owned by a monopoly, 10 guests. These were all recently privatized entities. In other words, not so long ago, grain silos were owned by the state. But they've been privatized, sold to a dominant player. And this dominant player, Senbet, abuses its dominance by discriminating on what discriminating on the prices it charges farmers to use its storage facilities. So if you are, all farmers have to use their storage facilities. But if you're selling to Senbet, you get a cheaper rate. But if you're not selling to Senbet, you're going to get a higher rate. Use these silos. And they're refusing some people use of these silos. That case has also been deferred to the tribunal. Other current cases that are big news right now is cases against the bakeries. There we find that bakeries, Blue Ribbon, Tasco, and Albany in particular, get together and determine the price that they sell to distributors. So the bakery sells to distributors, the distributor sends it to all the retail stores. And this came out of an investigation we had in the Western Cape, but being extended nationally now. We have in this case, for the first time, a very successful applicant of our corporate leadership program, and that's Blue Ribbon. And basically, the corporate leadership program is one of the parties that are colluding come to us and tell us everything that's going on. They will be immune from, they will have indemnity from prosecution. Okay, if they tell us stuff that we don't know already, if we knew it already, then they're not qualified. And Blue Ribbon has come forward, and so we've got a watertight case here, because one of the people within the cartel has told the other. Another case is about South African breweries. This is a case that's a little also complicated because it involves another regulator, the National Liquor Board, who we work closely with in dealing with this case. And here, this is about South African breweries having a distribution system that is exclusive and price discriminatory. In other words, if you become a distributor of, say, South African breweries beer, you get a license from them, but you'll only have a license to distribute in a particular geographic area. So I'll be given one part of Western Cape. By me, I cannot distribute it in another part in the Eastern Cape, say, for example. Okay, that's dividing markets, so they should give each person a particular market to distribute to, and only one person gets that market, so there's no competition between different distributors. Okay? over and above that, I would tell you, South African breweries will tell you what prices you will charge. Okay? That's the minimum retail price maintenance side of things. And if you are distributing SAB products, you will not distribute any other products. So if there's a new beer maker or there's a new soft drink company that says, look, you're already distributing SAB products, why don't you distribute mine as well? You might want to, but your contract with us can do is refuse. Okay? That's basically what that case is about. The other, the last point here is about another case, a guy Now, the thing is, you know, there's all these behaviors and relationships in the economy that are deemed anti-competitive in terms of the act. Okay? These are relationships either between competitors, people in a horizontal relationship, or between suppliers and customers, in other words, people in a horizontal, vertical relationship. Kind of like that's the SAB example. So there's all these things in the Act that are deemed anti-competitive, but you can get an exemption. You can be exempted from those provisions of the Act on the basis of very, very specific public interest criteria. In other words, you can come to us and say, look, we are flouting this Act, we're involved in this anti-competitive thing in terms of the Act, but there's very good reasons why we're doing this. So you must give us an exemption. And as long as your reasons correspond to those on the slide, we will, you know, you would stand a chance of getting exempted from it. So those are so in terms of the Act, you can get an exemption from anti-competitive behavior if you are maintaining, if it has to do with the maintenance or promotion of exports. I'll give you an example there. We gave an exemption to citrus producers who came to us and saying, look, we've got to get together as citrus producers in order to be effective with our exports. We individually, we're not going to be able to be very successful. But if we get together, so we haven't given this, I'm not sure where we're at, but we're considering this is one of the cases we've had, right? So so in that circumstances, we would say, in effect, okay, you can collude with each other because it's achieving some good in terms of promoting the country. The other is the promotion of SMMEs and business owned by HDI to become competitive. Here, we've given an exemption to the National Energy and National Healthcare Network, which is, you know, there's three companies in healthcare, hospitals, in the hospital market in this country. There's Life, which is Amrock, there's Mediclinic, and there's Medicare. Okay, and then there's a whole bunch of other independents that have formed a little association called the NHA. And they came to us and said, look, we're in a market where there's, you know, about 25-30% is distributed to each of the other three. We about 40 companies making the other 20% part. And if we don't get together in order to set our prices collectively, we're not going to be able to compete with the other three. And so they got an exemption on the grounds that we were promoting SMEs and business owned by the okay, the exemption should also be given to stop the decline of the industry, economic stability of the industry. You can also get exemptions in terms of your intellectual property rights. So if you have intellectual property rights for a particular pharmaceutical drug, for example, you have a monopoly over it. That's what I'm lying at there. And professional rules, in other words, you know, if doctors are getting together, or if architects or lawyers are getting together in order to give expression to their professionalism, that's fine. There's professional reasons, they might maintain standards, or whatever the case is. But so we can allow that, and we would consider that collusion. I spoke a little bit about a corporate leniency program, which is about, I'm not going to go through it again, yes, I've spoken a lot about now our work regarding complaints, anti-competitive behavior. The other section of our work that I pointed out earlier is about merger control, controlling mergers so that we don't result in higher concentration going forward. Mergers are defined as a change of control. So if there's a change of control in a company that's a merger, one bunch of people taking over control from another. We've divided mergers into small, intermediate, and large by setting thresholds. There's two thresholds, and above the first one is a large, and between the two is intermediate, and below the second one is low. And the test we have on whether we prohibit or allow a merger is we ask three questions. We say, is this merger going to substantially lessen or prevent competition in a particular market? Then you say, are there any technological efficiency or pro-competitive justifications for this merger? In other words, we might find that it prevents competition, it leads to higher concentration, but there might be some good reasons for, you know, there might be justifications for merging. And then we also got to consider public interest grounds, which are listed on the slide. What is the effect of this merger on a particular industry or region? Employment effects, what are the effects of small business and historically disadvantaged individuals, and what is our ability to compete internationally. Okay, so these are public interest grounds that sometimes, and I must repeat sometimes, and not always, comes into conflict with competition rules. So in other words, there'll be times that something is anti-competitive, but there's good reasons for us to allow it. We did this, for example, in the Saldanha Steel merger. In the Saldanha Steel merger, if we didn't allow it, that whole town of Saldanha, that whole steel mill might have been closed down. That would have resulted on the first two of those criteria we would have done badly. It would have affected a whole industry, a whole region, that whole town of Saldanha was dependent on the steel mill, and it would have affected employment. So, you know, there are instances where they come into conflict, but I must point out that in most instances, competition, just the competition analysis is consistent with the public interest analysis. In other words, if something is more competitive, it's more likely to produce employment, it's more likely to promote small business, it's more likely to get us to compete internationally. It is more common. There are some instances where they do conflict, but I'm not concerned that they are, you know, they are not the majority of the cases. Just a little slide showing how our merger cases have increased over time. Essentially here, I think one of the things we need to do as an institution now is we need to lower the threshold, because we're sitting with the same staff we had 7 years ago, but we've got like a 60% increase in caseload, and of course the cost of money has changed, and we set those thresholds, so we need to set the thresholds higher so we catch real caseload. Some of the mergers we've prohibited in the year under question, we only prohibited 4 out of 394 mergers. Four are listed here. I'm not going to go into them in great detail. It's just to say that the Sasol engine merger got a lot of publicity. It was an important merger for us to put in that. The parties didn't even appeal that decision, which meant that, you know, it was a decision that would be difficult to win an appeal. The Foscor Sasol issue, once again, an issue a merger we prohibited having to do with fertilizer. Medicrop Prime Cure, this is an interesting thing here, is that it was a merger in the hospital industry, which was a large merger which the commission said we should prohibit. The tribunal agreed with us, but when the parties took it and appealed to the competition appeal. Okay. I a long time about this, but a particular point that you made here, and that is, you know, this law is a very policy-driven law. It's a law that kind of takes into account a policy choice made around competition being a driving force in economic growth. And, you know, one of the things I'm seeing, at least, and I should speak for myself here, because it's a controversial thing, is that as policy-driven legislation gets interpreted by lawyers and judges, you know, if you take a policy-driven law and you throw it to the legal guy, you sometimes lose touch. The legalese takes over. The discourse becomes different. The way this is being tackled and spoken about becomes different. And the you know, then it's like technicalities. What's the Oxford Dictionary mean of this word? It's like if people lose sight of the policy purpose of the legislation. And the controversial thing, I suppose, I'm saying is I think that's what happened here in the PhD. They were lawyers. They were not policy-driven people. They became, the law became a thing of itself, and they forgot looking at behind what is the purpose of this law. But that's a, we can talk about that if you would like to later. Conditions, we of those 394 mergers, I said we prohibited four. We put conditions on 14 of them. I've just listed three of them here. Just to give you a kind of taste of what kinds of conditions we put. There's essentially three categories here. We can either put a behavioral condition, like we did to this international merger, Intelsat and Canon, which is a satellite merger. Okay? So in this merger, the satellites over Africa was going to be owned by in excess of 70% of which after this merger would have been owned by one firm. This is a serious thing. You know, I mean, there are parts of Africa that are not going to get a cable to it. Your only chance of getting communication to it is through satellite. And we felt very strongly about this merger. We were very close to prohibiting it. But we then put a behavioral condition saying, because it came to our attention that in the next 5 years there will be new engines and new satellites put up. You know, one of them, I think, is the RAF satellite, which is South Africa's involved in putting up. And, you know, in the light of these new entrants, we didn't have a good enough argument to try and prohibit it, because, you know, sure, 70% now, but in 5 years' time, we know there'll be new entrants, so that 70% will drop. So what we did there is we put a behavioral condition saying, from now until the time that the new satellite comes up, this merged entity will not increase its prices. Okay, no price increases from now until the new competition comes in. That's a behavioral condition. A structural condition is where you break up the firm. So when A.P. Moller - Maersk and Visa and Ned Lloyd merged, these are shipping companies, and we found that they would hold a monopoly in the Cape Town to Southampton route. And we said you must sell part of those business, some of those liners, to a third player, so that there's still competition in that market. That is a structural condition. The fourth kind of condition is employment-related conditions. This is what we did at the Tiger Brands Ashton Channing merger. There weren't big major competition problems here, but 1,000 seasonal workers would have lost their jobs as a consequence of the merger. Our condition on it is that a fund we needed to be set up to reskill and retrain the change workers. Okay, so those are just the kind of things. So the current merger cases are the things we are currently dealing with. I'm happy to talk about them in great detail. Some of them I've gone past. Telkom GCX, this is an important merger. We prohibit the our argument is to prohibit this merger. This is a merger about the lease that will prevent access to infrastructure. In other words, Telkom owns the telephone lines, they're on the infrastructure. BCX is a value-added network service provider. It does internet, all those kinds of things. And if there's a vertical relation between Telkom and BCX, then Telkom may not give other competitors of BCX equal access to that infrastructure. And if that happens, we are creating a particularly anti-competitive situation. And in Telkom is, as we all know, something that is blocking the growth of this. We need to open this thing up. We need to really open it up. Everybody must have access to the infrastructure, and this is a problem. The fear here is that if this merger takes place, Telkom will favor BCX at the expense of other competitors to BCX. Okay. Prime Media Car SN, this is a merger we asked to be prohibited. The tribunal didn't agree with us, and they allowed this merger. Okay, this was a merger in the radio sector. Prime Media on 702, it was going to buy Kaya FM, and it was then own two radio stations in Gauteng, and we lost this thing on a technical point about whether there was indeed a change of control or not. Okay, basically the argument is that the structure of the new entity the tribunal fund would not give sufficient control to Prime Media to produce. It didn't have the power to influence decision making on the Kaya board. Pick and Pay Food and Bed City, this is a merger that we felt very strongly about to prohibit it, and the party demanded the merger. In other words, we didn't challenge our position. Nila Mutiara, once again, is a merger in the fertilizer industry. Okay. I just want to go very quickly through these remaining slides. The Competition Commission and Tribunal, I think clearly one of our achievements is the very high regard we have internationally. You know, one of the things we've done up front is we defended our stance around including public interest criteria in our evaluation. It's a very controversial thing. Most other jurisdictions in our way is a separate. And we're saying, let's just be honest, we're coming from a place where we have to do this. We've been very inspirational, I think, even if I say it to myself, to other developing countries around this issue. Because you know, Europe and the United States would say, you don't do that. Economics is just about economics. The public is just media science. And we've introduced new, you know, we've asserted our right to be able to do this, and it's effective. No one is questioning us about it. In fact, the Mexicans and the Koreans and other people are kind of beginning to, kind of adopt similar kinds of approaches. We've got a similar thing called the International Competition Network. We host this as a network of agencies that's setting up this. We hosted a conference last year. We have since last year observed a status of the OECD's competition committee. Advocacy work I've spoken briefly about is an important thing where we influence other people to be without prosecuting them to begin to work in a competition friendly way. Something I have not received a lot of media attention, but two very significant things are the first two bullet points in the slide. The first is the Flyers Ombudsman, who deals with kind of short-term insurance issues, found that if you went to the bank and you took out a home loan, you bought a house, you took out a home loan, the bank has a to tell you who you will take your insurance out with. Okay? Okay, so you just want to get a home loan from the bank. You want to shop around and get your cheapest insurance, but they're not allowing you to shop around. They say, if you take a loan with us, you will take this insurance. And the fire ombudsman found that that was anti-competitive behavior and evoked the Competition Act to change that. And there were changes made to the Short-Term Insurance Act, not coming from us, but coming from the influence we've had over other adjudicators and regulators. This is an example of successful advocacy. We didn't have to do it. We just got other people to behave in competition-friendly ways. The same thing happened with the pension fund adjudicator. The pension fund adjudicator found that people who had taken annuity funds, you know, their retirement funds, they couldn't switch from one to the other. In other words, you're sitting with this, all your retirement money in this fund, and you think this fund is going to go down the tube, but you don't have the power to change to another fund. Because, you know, and he found that that was, and he ruled against the retirement industry, they're evoking competition rules. Which is a very interesting thing that's happening. So other institutions are using our laws, competition law, to take their decisions as well. I think that's a very positive thing. Then I've spoken a little bit around our relationship with other institutions, around competition, you know, getting MOUs. We've got a joint working committee with the CASA. We've done workshops with the State Agents Board. The State Agents Board does some very, very anti-competitive things, and with the excuse that we've been doing it for years. And we said, well, it doesn't matter, you've been doing it for years, it's still wrong in terms of the law. And we, you know, we felt with a bunch of people like that, it would be better to do advocacy rather than get adversarial with them and go through all the trouble of litigation, because there are sometimes people who genuinely don't know. They have really been doing it for years. Okay, so that's just some few points in advocacy. Our most successful, I think, advocacy campaign has been our banking inquiry. There's a long history to this, which I can speak to for a long time. But essentially, this inquiry was the root of it. There's some research done by National Treasury about 3 years ago that said, look, there's problems in the national payment system. We should get the Competition Authority to look at it. We then did our own research in the national payment system. And, you know, briefly, the national payment system is that set of institutions and processes that occur. When you find your credit card, when you find your credit card at the till point, right, how does the money go from your account into the retailer's account? What happens? Well, what happens is the national payment system kicks in. There's a whole lot of institutions behind the scenes that takes the money from your account and puts it into the account that it belongs to. Okay? And this is mediated by an institution called BankServe, on which all the banks sit on their board, but it's an institution that's located in the Reserve Bank. And there's other intermediaries like Visa has its own, MasterCard has its own, but the main one is BankServe. And we found that, our research found that the way in which that national payment system was governed is that it created a forum for the banks to could exchange information and collude with each other. Okay? So we've embarked on dealing with this, what I think is quite a creative thing. We've not again gone the big stick route of prosecution. What we said is the complicated thing, the most important thing here to get the system to work is for consumers to be more aware of how the system works and what their rights are within it. So the best thing we can do here is to create market transparency. It's to get everybody to understand how this complicated thing called the national payment system works. You know, to open it up. This mustn't be the domain of kind of economists and people who talk through jargon all the time. You must all understand it. So the whole process is about having public inquiries, getting voluntary submissions, and to make public what the finding of this is, and essentially we will come out of this in about September, October this year with a set of recommendations on what are the problems regarding access to the payment system. Okay, so access to the payment system, if you want to set up your bank now and you produce your own credit card, also your own new bank credit card to work, you've got to get in on the national payment system. How do you get in? When sitting on the board are already the four dominant banks, and they might not want a new guy. You know, how do you get access to the payment system? And then, more specifically, the very, very burning consumer issue that's emerged out of this is that there appears to be no logic on how bank charges are like that. It's just illogical. What is it based on? Is it based on how much effort they put? There's no logic to it, because we want to understand how do these guys arrive at their bank charges. Okay, that's very brief, but I'm going to move forward to perhaps my last slide. One of the things we've done that I should point out in the last year, maybe starting in October, November last year, is the institution is going through this renewal, rejuvenation. We've done a strategic planning exercise, one of those big organizational things. We've got Patrick from Zero, the team of management to come in and run these planning exercises. And we found that, these are strategic things now that we can do organizationally to just refine this organization and get it to be sharper, get it to work more intelligently, to be more effective. These are the issues we've come up with, staff morale and motivation. We've had a huge problem where we get in new guys, we train them, we make them skilled, give them the skills, they stay with us, and our best guys are being poached by the private sector who pay sub-salaries and we can't produce it. Okay, so we need to kind of come up with a whole way of dealing with this issue. We've got a lot of ideas of, but there seems to be a lot of commitment to kind of help us from DGI help us deal with that problem. The others are pretty organizational type issues around how we work, getting work processes aligned, kind of refining our methodology, making that work better for us, how we treat information and knowledge, are we making our decisions and the best available information for the time. And we need to keep up our communication. Well, thank you very much. That's my not so brief talk. I'll take any questions.
Thank you, remember, the camera on my little person, so time, I have another meeting, but what I wanted to know was, you are acting now.
No.
You can confirm this. Oh, that's good. Well, I have to say today. Just let me just ask you a few questions, but you see the book that is with us now says you are acting. Now, one thing I want to know, can I just take 10 minutes? Okay, so December, Sibiya, Mkono, Kamede, and Matwahela. But let me just ask one question, particularly with people who do their work. How honest are you? In one way or another, you would be fired. You recommend me. And what insight did you keep back? Then, just clarify this to me. If BMW offers me what Mercedes-Benz does not offer, would that be some kind of not doing well in business, was many members of parliament get these offers because they are members of parliament. Then let's take the hemp plant in Rosemary, where we've been there, we've seen how it's assembled, and for them to further market their product, they give us 40% off. They go to this London, they have Mercedes-Benz, they have everything. If they do give, they will say, well, you can take it for 10 to 15% down. Oh, yeah, what we offer in the open market. What would you say? Why, what factors is that? Yeah, let me just ask those two for now. Mr. Chamber?
Thank you, Mr. President. On the annual report document that is in front of us, which specifies the rector has had successful interventions with the government department. And then, maybe if you can elaborate more, one would like to know. Which are those departments and how are they feeling about the policy and the practice? And then trade unions is also, interested with what that relationship with the trade unions. What about an ordinary member of the community? How do you make sure that you send this information as far as the rural areas are concerned? You make the roadshow in these provinces. When are you going to maybe make yourself known to these other remaining provinces? And do you really think the roadshows are enough to send information? So you said this workshop that you are holding, how are you really intending? What kind of things that you've got in place to interact with people in the rural area so that they are aware of the transparency on the information? And the joint working committee with the council. Who's in the group? Who's in the committee?
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. When the presentation was given, I gained the impression that the competition commission functions mainly at the consumer level and not that much at the production level. I may be wrong. And therefore, if that is the case, how then do we talk of fair and free competition if, for instance, Lever Brothers dominate the cosmetic market in terms of selling soaps and things and so on, in the sense that they are the ones that, I don't know, people talk of patents and the property, like, I don't know. If I were to make soap myself, I just have to have some agreement with them because they're the ones that dominate the soap making industry. So, at that level, can we say indeed the trade is, but the competition is free and fair? Because it means if I want to have a father that sells soap, I have to have an agreement with the people that supply me with soap. I can't make it myself. Secondly, when you were showing us about the major control measure, not major, sorry. You indicated that there are some control, there are some measures which your structure prohibited, approved conditionally, and so on and so forth. Now, in that context, will I be making sense if I say, as the competition authority, you also wield some form of anti-monopoly power? Will I be making sense? And if indeed I do make sense, is that coupled also with price pegging power? Because I don't know, some people tell me that in business one is not allowed to buy a thing, let's say for 10 rand and sell it 20 or 30, because that will be 100% profit or 100 whatever. You can't go to beyond the price which you bought to make profit. I don't know how far through that is. Now, if indeed you have those trading powers, have you ever exercised them? And are you likely to exercise these in terms of the staple food of most of the poor and the people, things like bread, meal, and so on and so forth? Lastly, under the international contributions, you mentioned organizations like UNCTAD, OECD, and so on. I didn't hear you say anything about the World Trade Organization. Are the compelling reasons for us not to have anything to do with that organization, if indeed we don't? Thank you.
The next question was
Firstly, congratulations on your appointment, Mr. Rambo.
I told you there are no other words.
I'm used to match fixing, not fighting. So when I get easily confused here now, as a first question. With regard to these cases, I'm not going to go much in connection with price, but with regard to these court cases, which I want to suspect a huge burden on you, what is the best approach there? Should we really continue to encourage you to take those people, or does it really work vis-a-vis when one weighs advantages and disadvantages of taking them? I suppose if you must take them to court, you also have to bear court. And I don't know to what reason. And I don't know how flexible your budget is to accommodate all those cases. Although this topic is very, very important to be done. That's just one question. And then lastly, because I promised that I was going to be brief, you seem to be encouraging practices like fair competition and stuff like that, which is a very good idea. But also, you are also worried about the poaching of the staff. And how does that relate to this fair competition that you're talking about? It's only towards consumables and not labor and stuff like that. I mean, because in terms of law, you also have what is called immaterial or intellectual property rights. If I happen to be empowered more than others and I'm up for the market, and how do you stop me from being, approached by other entities? I know it's a big problem, it affects us, but we really have a remedy around it.
Thanks, Chair. Once more, I must also say congratulations, because that was the first question I was going to ask. Was it still acting? You wanted to break a record on acting. Now, how do you classify the measure, the small, intermediate, and large? Which stick do you use? Say this one is small, whether the one that has got 2 million, 5 million, or 35, or whatever. Now, on the issue of staff losses, you cited one reason that maybe you cannot afford, to pay the salaries, right? But I look here, the people who left were any more than half a million. And is that in your competition, as a commissioner that deals with competition, is that really not competitive? The people that I see that have left, really, if I had known that there was going to be a vacancy, I would apply there. The issue about pick and pay and fruit and veg, it has been in the media recently, and that measure did not go through. Was it because of structural conditions or employment-related issues, so that we could have a feel? I know there are some of the issues that are coming in your commission. Now, you mentioned lastly the issue about bank charges, which are a pending issue also these days. But then there are other charges. One colleague of mine was telling me that, you know, in the shops they have targets, whether Woolworths, Jet, and so on. And if they see that they are not going to meet the target this month, they just say to all the customers, administration fee 3 rand. Everybody, so you've got 2,000 customers, clients, and you multiply that 1 million, then you reach your target, because no one is going to check this 1 rand or 3 rand administration fee. How do you control that? Because it then impacts and limits competition. Lastly, it would be the issue about these, I don't know what you call these two companies, two or three that did that, register people on ITC, credit bureaus. Those people, aren't they monopolizing? And because it's only them, and shops have to use only them, and there's just no other alternative. And lastly then, would you need a complainant first? So no matter would come before you, before a complaint has been laid. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. What interests me most is, in the beginning, is the bank charges. Is the bank going to be left like that without verifying how they get to these bank charges? Because if you look at Capitec and look at Standard Bank, you'll find that they, although the one bank is older and larger, will charge higher bank charges for withdrawals than the smaller or the bank that's in the later. I know that is competition, but you also look at those things, because for me it is vital that we know how they get to these charges, these fees they're charging us. Now I want to know, are you going to leave it like that, or are you going to do something about that? The other thing is, what I have noticed is on property, that even if it's rent, even if it's not selling or buying, you will see that it's more or less the same in certain areas. So that is one of the things. And the third thing, maybe it's not in the field, maybe you can help us through the lounge of the chair, but I think it's important, especially for the illiterate people, because when you get into a shop, you'll see there's a price. When you get to the sale, you find it. I know there's a consumer side. I said maybe it's outside. I asked them that when you get to the sale, they say it's not the right price. The price is never less. It's always more. So I know if you pay the price, you should see. And sometimes you don't feel like going to fight with a manager, and then you just take it. So kind of these big notices to tell the people that the price you see is the price you pay, and so that the managers can be confronted with that. Thank you very much, Oliver Chair.
Okay. Okay, let's go to 19 questions. I hope I reach out to them. I'll just take that from the top, right? Look, on whether we're honest or not, that is a good question that has to be asked all the time. Okay? You know, my view, of course, is that we are honest, but it's more complicated than that. I mean, I think that one of the roles of Parliament, for example, is to see that we are honest. That's why we come here. You need to judge us in that way. Okay? But I must say that I had the pleasure and luxury of working at MEDLAC at the time that this policy and law was taken to MEDLAC. And a lot of thought went into this issue. A lot of thought went into the issue of how do we ensure
impartial, independent institutions that are never going to be captured by private sector and powerful interests. And there's a few things we've done, I think, that make us, that takes care of that. One is the institutional design. Okay? The way we've designed the institution. We're not like ICASA, where one organization does everything. We've separated it. So you've separated investigation and prosecution from adjudication. When we go before the tribunal, we're an equal player to the other party that's defending our action. Okay? So the separation of powers is the one thing that's led to the second take, you know, fresh take. You know, we've thought about it to the level of detail where you have three tribunal members taking a decision, not one. Okay? We have, in other words, if you look at the system as a whole, and if you've got to start bribing people from the outside, well, there's a hell of a lot of people you're going to have to bribe, because it's not, all the power is not in one place. Okay, so there's a corporate governance issue here around how we've designed the issue, and overall it has a corporate governance. It has a governance, let's take out the word corporate. It has a governance that ensures checks and balances. Then the second thing is the legal nature of our proceedings, and there's a question later on about this, gives everybody the kinds of rights that gets them to challenge, you know. So I'm complaining here about, well, you know, Telkom's taking us to all the courts in the land, but those are their rights. They have the right to do that. They can use those rights, you know, constructively or not so constructively. In my view, they're not using it constructively. But you have a right to challenge decisions taken. You have the right to appeal. And furthermore, the way in which the processes are designed, the proceedings of the institution, is done in a transparent way. So anybody can walk off the street and sit down in the tribunal hearing and hear what anyone is saying. So between institutional design, the corporate governance, the transparency, the legal rights that people have, we are, I think, we've taken care of that honesty issue pretty much. You know, I'm not saying it's in the bag, but pretty much. So, and in other words, the transparency is an important thing, but if you're doing it, then nobody knows what you're doing. Nobody understands what decision you've taken. If you don't explain your decision, then if you just, you know, act in an autocratic way without providing the reason for what you're doing, which is one of the big principles. Every tribunal decision, they provide a set of reasons. Not just a decision, they've got to tell you why they took that decision. So that's the issue around honesty. I mean, I think that's the important issue that people must continue to ask and always ask. I'm not so clear about that question around whether BMW and Mercedes-Benz give you 40% off. Is that competitive or not? I think you're talking about a very artificial market there. You know, we deal with markets to general consumers, not the market for luxury cars to parliamentarians. That seems to be a separate market. So I'm just going to leave that one for a bit. Then there's a question around annual report, page 35, working with other government departments. This is very interesting because it's kind of taken up a lot of our time in the recent past. What we're finding is that, look, you know, who we've worked with, I suppose that's what you're asking, and how is that going? You know, is that like, how, what are these interactions like, and how do the government departments feel about it? Well, and what inputs are we making in policy? So the big inputs we've made is on telecommunications bill, what is now the electronic communication law, I think. We've made inputs to the MIGP, we've made inputs at an earlier time on the sugar bowl. But what we're finding is There's a few departments we work with more than others. So the Department of Forestry, the forest privatization, that's something we've dealt with in form of mergers. Department of Health, we have input from them on our health mergers. There's the Department of Mineral and Energy Affairs, as far as fuel prices, that's all case of concern. They collaborated, they gave us, provided us with information. And then Department of Public Enterprises, that was, you know, SAA, those issues around, SAA, they, you know, we kind of collaborated, we worked with them proper that. Increasingly, we're finding that, you know, like in the next 2 weeks, I've got meetings with the Department of Mineral and Energy Affairs and the Department of Public Enterprises coming to talk to us, look, how do we better structure our relationship, coming to seek advice from us of whether some other plan they're wanting to embark on is consistent with competition policy principles. That's happening increasingly more and more. One of the reasons why that's happening, I'm going to share with you, is that, like, this has come from Minerals and Energy Affairs. They're saying, look, when we want to speak to people in the private sector, say on petrol pricing or any issue, we've been told by the private sector guys, we can't speak to you because if we do, the Competition Commission is not going to be happy because they're going to perceive this as collusion. Which is a very rich thing to say. I mean, that's not true. You know, this is private sector guys now trying to play up the government department against the Competition Commission and get us to using us as an excuse to not subject themselves to one or other form of regulation coming from a government department. So this is a problem which we currently is happening. I mean, it's happening right now. You've got people who are saying they don't want. You know, of course, if a government department gets together a bunch of competitors and facilitates their collusion, we will have jurisdiction over that, and we will have something to say, and we'll have a case to be made. But that is not why these government departments are wanting to meet with these private sector people. They're not wanting. The purpose of it is not to get them to collude. There's other policy issues that they're trying to clarify and advance in this interaction. So your question is interesting, I think, because I see a move in the private sector to pitch to the government departments against them. And fortunately, the ones they've chosen first are the ones that we have particularly good relationships with, so they're not going to get anywhere with that. But I think it's something they'll try their luck on as we go forward. I'm going too slowly on these questions. There's a question about our outreach, and those points are well taken. I mean, I think that we perhaps are not doing enough around our outreach work. You see that one of our strategic planning things is advocacy and communication. It's something, quite frankly, you know, without putting any effort into, we've done a lot of good publicity in the last year, and we don't have a communications division in the organization. You know, in other words, and I think we prioritize correctly, quite frankly, because we prioritize on getting the cases moving, and that generated its own publicity without having spin doctors trying to get in the newspaper. I mean, I think that's right, but I think that in the next phase we need to do outreach and explain things more and go out further and get people to have a deeper and more sophisticated understanding. So that's a point that's well taken. JWC with ICASA, we're reigniting this now for two reasons. It's happening currently, so in the next month this structure will meet. But there's two things that happened, if you recall. One is that ICASA's, the act has changed. That happened in the last year. And of course, ICASA's had some very, very serious staff turnover in the last year. So between those two things, we're kind of starting a little bit afresh with them. There's a new bunch of people and there's a new act, and we'll start again with them around the next year. Okay, then there's a question about CC functions at the consumer level and not a producer level. Okay, well, look, those two things are linked, right? right? So in economics and in the exchange, you have supply and demand. You have a producer and a consumer. What is correct in what you're saying is that we are on the side of the consumer. That's who we act on their behalf. But who are we acting against most of the time is the producer. Okay? So, and for a whole bunch of things around the way they behave and their pricing. I'm not sure that answers your question. Okay. And you're absolutely right about primarily what we are concerned about is anti-monopoly. Having one firm in a particular market and leaving and consumers being at the mercy of the firm is a problem, you know. And just to say that, you know, when you say consumers, it's not only end consumers. It's not only the person who goes to a retail store and buys a consumable like food or clothing. Businesses are consumers. I think there was another question about that. Businesses are consumers of banking services. Businesses are consumers of telecommunication services. And those are big costs for businesses, telecoms and banking. So when we talk about consumers, we're not only talking about end consumers, but those businesses out as consumers as well. And one of the DCI's policy issues is around the cost of intermediate goods. So the cost of steel, the cost of chemicals, these are the high costs of these intermediate goods result in high costs in manufacturing. It's the feeling in DCI and their policy stance is that one of the things that's preventing the growth of the manufacturing industry in this country is the high cost of those intermediate goods. So just think of consumers more broadly than just the end consumer. But what you write about is that, and this has happened in the recent past, and it's something I personally feel strongly about, is that we as an institution need to demonstrate our benefits to the end consumer, and in particular, poorer consumers. So it is no coincidence that you're going for food issues, you're going for bread, you're going for milk, you're taking a tough stance on pick and pay, because those are the things that affect poor people. And you know, the kind of cost of bread and, you know, and the cost of fertilizer. You know, that's not a coincidence. The cost of fertilizer is an input into agriculture that raises the cost of food in the end. So there is a big emphasis in the Commission on going for issues that affect poorer consumers. Okay? WTO, you're absolutely right, it ought to be in the WTO, but this is something that is run by DCI. We called upon to kind of give input when there's a competition issue in DCI to be dealt with. The competition subcommittee of DCI has been scrapped, by the way. That's an issue that didn't make it onto the agenda. You know, there's been a lot of debate around what is on the WTO agenda. There's been big battles around what gets on and what doesn't get on. And we haven't played a forward big role there. Those other committees I spoke about are specifically competition related. So we go to the OECD, we go to their competition subcommittee. We go to UNCTAD, we go to the competition subcommittee. We coordinate with the Department of Foreign Affairs, actually. We have to coordinate some of this involvement with. Price fixing, court cases, what is the best approach? That's an interesting question that was asked. And the short answer to it is that we do have some level of prosecutorial discretion in deciding how to proceed with the case. We could have decided, for example, to make a case against the bank. Use the stick, but we didn't. We said, look, it's going to be cheaper, more effective if we do this inquiry. Because if we just went for example, there, if we just went for prosecuting them, we'd get caught up in a whole lot of legal mumbo jumbo occurring in court and people talking at an not to go that deep. We decided, let's kind of get these things in the open. Let's have a bit bigger, broader debate. So then we decided not to go the prosecutorial route, because it would be time-consuming, and they with the expertise and the deep pockets they have, they would tie us up in knots, quite frankly. Okay, so we've got to be intelligent about which cases we take up and which cases we get the advance. So that's one of the things we say in our strategic planning must tell us to do, and to be more focused. Don't take any case, you know, every case. Take the more effective case. Take the case that affects poorer people. You know, choose. We might have a set of criteria by which we decide which are the cases we choose. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question now, but. Okay, then there's a question about encouraging fair competition. That's good, but what about approaching for self? Well, you're absolutely right, that's fair competition. You know, I mean, we can't compete. One of the things we will do around this is we want to make representation to the Minister of Trade and Industry and say, look, we've done an exercise. We've got Deloitte doing an exercise for us where they have benchmarked our salaries against the market. They looked at our salaries and said, well, what if somebody is working in the general market, and our salaries, you're right, are not so bad. I mean, our scales overlap with the market scale. The market scale is higher, but ours, there's some level of overlap. It's not way thing, but you know, there are salaries that, you know, you spoke about looking at Iron Team. I don't know whose salary you have in mind. But I can tell you that I don't know if Mondo and Clara's there.
In Tuli. It was in Tuli, Dreya. Mkla is not here.
Well, this was a person.
Oh, Mkla is there. M. Mkla.
How much is he earning?
187.
187?
Mm. Well,
but that was for a few months. He is probably earning about, I don't know, 450,000. A good salary, okay, but she is now working for Cliff Decker, and she's earning 1.5 million a year. Okay, so at that level of seniority, you know, we can't compete. It's like, it's just, you know, look, people are paying, private sector is paying enormous amounts of money to competition lawyers. You want to complain about this, but one can also see this as our success. You know, if businesses are putting this amount of resources to deal with us, there must be something we're doing particularly right. You know, if buying these skills are worth so much to them. So it is a double-edged thing, and I'm not sure, you know, we've been engaging this all the time, and, you know, we will. How do we classify mergers? We classify mergers by having, there's two things we take into account, annual turnover and asset value. Okay, and the Minister of Trade and Industry sets these two thresholds. I can't remember them offhand, but they, the highest threshold would be, $100 million, and the lowest threshold would be $10 million. So between above $100 million of annual turnover and all things, you are large. Between the 10 and 100, you are intermediate and below the 10 you are towards. Okay, I'm sorry, I can't remember the figures of like that. Okay, I've answered the staff lottery. Pick and pay.
It was structural employment related.
No, pick and pay was a straight down the line competition analysis. In other words, what we did with pick and pay is we looked at the national market of the big players nationally, but then we went into local areas, and there's some areas, you know, I don't know, Kimberley, very local areas. local market where if Pick and Pay bought off Food and Bed City, they would control over 75% of fruit and veg sales in those in local markets. So we did the analysis at a national level and at a local level. And of course it differed in local level. Some places, you know, they took over, there were many other competitors, and in other places that were, they would have just, like Newcastle, they would have just changed. They would have been a big player in Newcastle, like about 70%. Okay, so that's with that. Bank charges, yes, of course there are other charges and admin fees, and this is precisely the thing we're trying to do. These admin fees, you know, there's a thing that banks charge called research fees that I came across the other day. Now, what is research fees? You know, I mean, banks, people are making up fees. This is a problem. People are making, they're pulling it out of a hat. They don't relate to anything in real life sometimes. And I mean, that's a problem. And that is precisely what this is about. I don't want to pronounce on this thing and give you any conclusion. The questions we ask them. And in truth, what we have right now is the commission has a kind of arm's length relationship with the inquiry. The inquiry will go, find out what's going on, and then make recommendations to the commission, say, look, commission, this is what we found, this is what we think you should do. So I don't want to preempt any of that, but I mean, it is outrageous. These fees are outrageous. And then the common thing between banks, there's a commonality here between banks and telecom. There's a thing called interconnection fee, which is the same thing that works in the national payment system. Now, how does your bank connect with another bank if you hand out a check or use a credit card? That's interconnection that occurs. And interconnection fees, and then the same occurs like if you're MTN and you're boarding a Vodacom, you know, there's interconnection, okay? And what happens with interconnection fees is the incumbent sets the fee, right? And the consumer pays for it. So just think about what happens there. You MTN arm Vodacom, and you sit out here and say, let's set our interconnection fee. We're just going to pay each other. We're going to pass this cost on to the consumer. So why don't you charge me R10 and I'll charge you R10, even though it costs nothing. And then you put the R10 on your consumer's bill, I'll put the R10 on my consumer's bill, and they'll pay us. This is a bit of a funny thing going on here. Interconnection fees is the issue. It's a problem in economics of network industries. Network industries, and there's a whole economics around this, right? Credit bureaus, can I pass that question? This is not a competition issue, it's a consumer issue, and I think that's an issue that, I mean, except to say that GTI certainly, in theory, and you'll see it unrolling now from in the short term, we're committed to better consumer perception, and they've got a whole lot of institutions being set up around there, and that's certainly a set of institutions we need to be working more closely with. We don't always need a complaint. We most of the time, we are complaint-driven, but the commissioner can initiate his or her own complaint. So I can initiate the complaint on the basis of whatever information I pick up wherever. You know, and a lot of times we do that because a lot of times we get little complaints that are not made properly in terms of law, are not kind of, you know, and then we kind of non-refer, by the time we get it the 10th time, we begin to look, find a way of articulating that complaint that touches everything. You know, sometimes one person complaining about one small thing, another small thing, another small thing, but after a period of time they add up into a picture for us as an institution, enabling us to kind of more intelligently articulate the complaint. bank charges. Yes, I mean bank charges are the bank that you are using. Property, we've got a, the property prices are not an issue for us so far. You know, property prices are very market related, market determined, is what people can pay. And there's all this kind of logic here that is market related. I don't know why some properties are more expensive than others in some locations. What is an issue for us is the fee that the estate agent charges. And this is where we have found state income price fixing occurs. Okay, so they all agree on charging a common fee. They're not allowed to undercut each other. Okay, that's the one issue. The other issue is that there's a cartel operating, and if you're not a member, you don't get, you know, you have all seen the special newspapers, and now they're doing it as a free newspaper, a property where you can buy it. But you've got to be a member of that association to get your ad in there. If you don't, if you're not a member, an estate agent is a member of whatever that cartel is, you can't just get your ad in there. They won't allow it. So there's that kind of problem of closing in and keeping other people out. Okay? Mm-hmm. Those are the two big problems we have with property, and we are working with the state agent board and trying to kind of work through what that means for the practice of this real estate. Mm-hmm. I think I've covered everything.
Another one?
Thanks, let me greet everybody. It's my debut here, but it's because of what I got for the competition commission, more than anything. So it just struck me that the pick and pay and fruit and bread issue coincided with what I was going to ask, but from a different angle. Anti-competitive behavior at a local level. Sometimes we find in small dorpies, there's on one Makulu bus to dominate everything. Would the competition regard that as an anti-competitive behavior? Because if you want to set your father or anything, you just cannot because of the size of the dorpy. It's something which I'm sure one would assume that you wouldn't necessarily find in metropolitan, but small dorpies. Thank you.
And the short answer to your question is yes, and that is demonstrated in a variety of high ticket pay. The problems are that in the thresholds that we set for murders, they are so high and large that we catch mostly the national guys. It doesn't preclude us from catching the small guy, but it's the large ones where there's compulsory notification. So those just automatically come to us. The small ones, we've got to either be tipped off or look out for them. Okay, so that's the problem there, okay? And I think that everything is determined in this area of work, like the kind of intellectual, academic exercises around how you define markets. So some markets are national and some markets are local. So, you know, how do you define a market? You define it in terms of the product, and you define it in terms of the geography. So all products that are substitutable with each other are in the same market, and all as a geographic area. So, you know, it's very abstract. Let me give you an example that I think you take the, if you take our cases around South African breweries, right? So what is the market that South African breweries function in? Is it the market for beer? Is it the market for alcohol? Is it the market for all bottled drinks, including Coke and anything? Does the market include a market for fruit juices? Is the market, is milk in the same market as beer because you drink it? You know what I mean? So what is the market? And the market you will define as what is substitutable. So if you don't have beer, what will you drink? If you don't have you don't have beer, the consumer behavior is to replace beer with, say, vodka, say, for example, then vodka is the same in the same market as beer. Okay, so it's what's substitutable. But if you don't have beer, nobody's going to drink milk instead of beer. If I offer you beer, you say, no, thanks, what beer? I don't have any beer. You're not going to go for milk, you're going to go. So defining market is what gives a firm its dominance or not. So let's just look at this South African breweries case. If we define South African brewery, we as a competition agency would want to define the market as just beer. In which case they control 95% of the market. They are going to want to define the market as everything that a person drinks, including milk, including water, including orange juice. In which case they only have 2% of the market. Okay? So how you define a market will determine whether somebody is dominant in that market or not. Okay? So that's the one aspect of the product. The other aspect is their geography, which is, if somebody is in an area, how far will they travel to pick up this product? Right? So if in the case of saying buying motor vehicles, people shop around nationally, then the market is national. But if they only shop around in their 40-kilometer radius, then the market is at 40-kilometer radius. So you have markets that are very local, regional, and you have markets that are international. So if you want to buy a software product, that's an international market. That's not a local market. Sorry, I'm not sure where I'm taking this thing, but the point is that you can. There are many instances where markets are very local, and we need to be addressing that as well.
Are there any other
questions for anyone? Sure. And we also must thank you, Honorable Mr. Gellan, for being part of us for the whole time. We really looking forward for more.
Yes.
And thank you very much for the team members. Okay, thank you. But I think the children, you can just interact with each other. If you are in the room.
Thank you.